From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Today we bring you this week's update of news and events from Latin America and the Caribbean with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, reporting from Managua, Nicaragua. We begin with a report of Iranian ships delivering aid to sanctions-ridden Venezuela over the past week and a half. Both countries are subject to U.S. sanctions, and lately they've begun to coordinate a response. There's been really a great victory in this act of solidarity by Iran with Venezuela, and conversely as well. They're both the object of U.S. sanctions. They can both, be punished further if it's possible to be punished beyond, absolute torture for extending a helping hand to the other. But Iran and Venezuela, in like situations, the object of U.S. sanctions and U.S. warfare, oil-producing nations in each case, and this huge act of solidarity by Iran sending tankers to Venezuela to ease the quarantine and arriving safely and, under sort of a tacit guarantee, by the way, from China and a little less overtly from Russia.
Yeah, and various people have commented on this and kind of concluded that it's a significant geopolitical, geostrategic defeat for the United States. And I think that on the whole, they're right. Because so much depends on to what extent this very important lifeline that Iran has extended to Venezuela. And remember, this is a quid pro quo. It's years ago,
right,
when Iran was having very severe difficulties as a result of the sanctions imposed on it by the Europeans and their U.S. master. It was Hugo Chavez and his team that helped Iran out and helped them through a very difficult period. So what Iran's doing is repaying that favor. And Fidel Castro said many, many years ago that the only way the non-aligned countries or the majority world countries were going to be able to defend their interests was by combining together and working together in mutual defense of their interests and mutual promotion of their interests. He was really visionary, like Bolivar, and like Sandino, like so many of these outstanding leaders in Latin American history. And this is the latest example of the truth of what Castro and Bolivar and Sandino and all those other great leaders were advocating for, the unity of Latin America in their case. But more broadly, the unity of the impoverished majority world against their oppressors. And this is what Iran has done in this case, sending these five tankers loaded not just with gasoline, but also with important parts that Venezuela's two big refineries, they're able to refine diesel fuel,
right,
which is fine for heavy vehicles and for commercial freight vehicles and so on. But the refineries need special equipment, special spare parts to be able to refine gasoline, because the cracking process is a bit more complicated for,
that's right,
yep, or the refining process is a bit more,
yep,
complicated.
Yep.
And so a lot of that equipment was also sent by Iran on those tankers, and that will enable Venezuela's refineries to get back online and begin producing gasoline as well from their crude. And that's how I understand it.
Yep, these relations, by the way, have been, this kind of relationship has been being nurtured for a number of years now. I'm looking at
a New York Times article from March of 2007. Iran is already Venezuela's closest ally outside Latin America, with ventures to produce oil and build cars and tractors together. Now travelers between the countries can also take a weekly flight, which was inaugurated here on Friday, back in March of 2007, includes a stop in Damascus, was operated in a co-chair agreement by Venezuela's state-controlled airline and Iran's national carrier. It says that under Chavez, Venezuela has tightened relations with Iran and expressed support for its enrichment program. And it's also reached out to Syria, making plans to build an oil refining complex there. Chavez sees relations with Iran and Syria, both under U.S. sanctions, as a centerpiece of a foreign policy aimed at countering U.S. influence. And Iran's ambassador to Venezuela said Chavez is much loved in our country, and our people want to come here to get to know the Venezuelan people. At the time, Iran started building a Peugeot-inspired Simon sedan, it was called. It's a car in Venezuela.
Right. And also Nicaragua benefited from its relationship with Iran.
Yep.
Because Iran helped Nicaragua build at least one hospital there in Managua, and also it assisted Nicaragua with agricultural equipment and technical advice. So the relationship with Iran was certainly during the time when Chavez was alive and before Venezuela was under such a massive, broad, wide-ranging offensive from the United States and the European Union. And the relationship with Iran was not so much a bilateral one, although of course that was very important. It was also a relationship with the whole ALBA bloc of Venezuela, back then Ecuador, also Nicaragua, also Cuba. So that was it was a real attempt to build precisely the kind of practical expression of the vision that Fidel Castro and Hugo Chavez had of international South-South cooperation designed to protect the legitimate interests of the majority of world peoples. So now going back to these tankers, what it should mean is that, especially if Iran maintains that relationship and is able to continue assisting Venezuela both with hydrocarbon supplies like the scanning, but more importantly, the parts that Venezuela needs to reinstate its damaged through lack of maintenance refining capacity. So perhaps the most important thing in one sense is what has been the United States' reaction. Well, one of the reasons that people are probably right to count this as a severe setback for the United States in terms of its global power and prestige and influence is that the United States had deployed quite serious naval military forces in the Caribbean. I think it's the Fourth Fleet. In effect, attempting to impose a blockade, although they don't say that. They say that those naval military resources are there to serve the purpose of the fight against narcotics. Ha ha!
Right.
As if the United States is interested in stopping the flow of drugs to the huge market that keeps its financial industry
right
going
to its customers. Yeah, right.
Yeah, and so I'm more accurately, and if there is any element of narcotics control by the U.S. naval forces in the region, it's to make sure that rival cartels don't do as well as the U.S. Cartels. Anyway, and that's, and we could, and maybe we should do a program about that at some point.
Yeah.
And so then you had this huge naval contingent, certainly in comparative terms to the naval forces of any of the countries in the region, effectively attempting to blockade Venezuela and also prevent legitimate trade between Venezuela and Cuba, although I think that's likely to happen in the near future. We'll see. But they could potentially have stopped. And there was talk early on when the tankers were in the first stages of their journey to Venezuela, that people were envisaging a scenario in which U.S. forces might even attempt to board the Iranian tankers and stop them proceeding to Venezuela. Well, thankfully that didn't happen. And one of the reasons it didn't happen is because Iran made very clear that any attempt by the United States military forces to intercept or hinder the passage of their tankers would be met by reciprocal measures in the vicinity of Iran. I mean, presumably referring to the Straits of Hormuz, through which pass, 80% of the world's oil?
Some huge chunk here, right?
Yeah, so that is probably one of the principal elements that made the United States think twice about using its undoubted military potential and power against these five Iranian tankers. But another thing that must have made them think twice is the fact that very early on, was it about 3 weeks ago? Perhaps you remember better than I do. China's foreign ministry actually said that they would not allow. And I was very surprised about how strongly they phrased it. They said they would not allow a military intervention by the U.S. against Venezuela.
That's what they said.
Which is what they said. Yes. And of course, in Russia, has over many years now strengthened and trained the Venezuelan armed forces, in particular their air force and their missile capacity, their anti-aircraft capacity. So, and the I think it's the combination of those three things that made the United States think twice, and they were probably also in consultations with their European allies and Canada, who said they probably wouldn't find it helpful to have a major military conflict in Venezuela right now. There are all kinds of permutations, but probably those are the main elements of the making up the reason why the United States didn't attack or attempt to intercept the five Iranian tankers.
Right.
Now, what they have done is, and as part of their response is, I find it quite puzzling, but interesting. They've sent this quite small contingent so far. And so far, I think it's only 50 troops, to Colombia. Now, that's illegal. That's unconstitutional in terms of Colombia's Magna Carta. I mean, the foreign forces are not supposed to be based in Colombia. Foreign troops are not supposed to be based in Colombia. And the United States already has seven. I'm not sure if they refer to them as forward operating locations, but seven bases doing intelligence gathering, vigilance work, radar, and signals intelligence interception, that kind of stuff. And now they've sent this small force of troops, which are very embarrassing for Iván Duque, because a lot of people in the Senate, in the Colombian Senate, are saying, what's going on? Why are you violating the Constitution? And so that has actually created a problem for Duque at a time when he's also got a host of other problems, in particular legal problems in relation to his boss, former president, narco-terrorist Alvaro Uribe, and also on top of the COVID-19 epidemic. Maybe we can talk about the COVID-19 epidemic if we've got time later on. Okay. But I just thought that was I fail to see what advantage the United States gets apart from being able, for domestic purposes, being able to say, we're increasing the pressure on Venezuela and we're showing solidarity with our strong ally, Colombia. And maybe that's why they've sent this very small number of troops to Colombia. Or they, maybe they're going to expand it into a much larger force. We'll see, but at the moment it doesn't look like that.
Yeah.
And the other thing, that the United States have done is they kind of, they're bullying these small shipping companies, you know, one in Greece, one, there's a good report in Telesur that gives the breakdown of one that's flying the flag of the Marshall Islands, and these four shipping companies that were doing very low level freight and cargo work, delivering stuff to Venezuela, and the United States is threatened them with sanctions and blocking them from access to the U.S. financial system, which of course is a death sentence for any commercial company trying to do business in the Americas, obviously. So, but and that's, if you look at that, and what does that look like? It's like Mike Pompeo in his office with a fly swat, swatting a few flies. Right. That's what it looks like.
Right.
And that lends weight to the interpretation that the United States has suffered quite a serious setback in terms of its power, influence, and prestige around the world. But obviously, from our point of view, that's a good thing, and from the Iranian point of view, that's a good thing. But it'll be interesting to see how the U.S. response develops. The flip side of that is, they may feel that they don't need to do any more, because they may feel that they're like that Minneapolis police officer. They've got their knees so deep into the neck of Venezuela that they think it's only, you know, they're probably looking at their watch, oh well, it'll only be another 3 or 4 minutes and they'll be dead.
Right. Yeah, right.
Maybe that's what they're thinking.
They're already literally saying, I can't breathe, you know. It's this is the technique to use. Yeah.
So, you know, and that's exactly what it's like in terms of the kind of configuration of power, and that also is what makes this tremendous gesture of solidarity by the Iranian authorities so important, because it's the equivalent of coming along and kind of forcing the policeman to take his knee off the guy's neck.
Right.
Right, and that's what it's like. So, we'll just have to see what happens. But it's a huge boost for Maduro. Of course, it may alleviate the domestic situation somewhat. But that doesn't. It's a huge boost. But it also, you know, it just gives you the scale of the challenge. This overwhelming and kind of sadistic assault to which the Venezuelan people and the Venezuelan government have been subject for, what is it now? And practically ever since Hugo Chavez died back in, when was it, 2013?
Yeah.
So, you know, although it does give the Venezuelan authorities breathing space, they still have a long way to go before they can kind of get back to some kind of a situation where they can restore something approaching normal life to the population of Venezuela. But in that context, shifting to the COVID-19 epidemic and the effects in the region, and if you look at the deaths per 100,000 in the respective countries there, and Venezuela and Cuba, both countries that are facing savage economic attack and a kind of full spectrum attack, just short of military invasion, they are the most successful countries in the region with any population in terms of death per 100,000 as a result of the COVID-19 pandemic. In Venezuela's case, their deaths per 100,000 are at 0.06 per 100,000. And the Cuba's deaths per 100,000 are a little bit more, 0.8. Wow. But they're well ahead of countries like, for example, Brazil has 14.2 per 100,000, Mexico 8, Colombia has 1.9 deaths per 100,000. So they haven't done badly either.
Right.
And I thought they'd have done worse.
Right.
And these are figures from last week.
Yeah, Mexico's easing, right? So, they're starting to back off of the restrictions now.
Yeah, today they started easing up.
Yeah.
And in Brazil, the city of Rio de Janeiro has started to ease up.
Uh-huh.
So we'll see how things go. But in Nicaragua, it's interesting that Honduras has it's 2.2 COVID deaths per 100,000 against.
Wow.
0.5 in Nicaragua and 0.7 in El Salvador. So it's just interesting that Nicaragua didn't shut down. It just applied various protective measures and encouraged various protective measures. And its figure per 100,000 is 0.5,
right.
0.58.
Right.
And that's less than its neighbors in Honduras and El Salvador.
Right, that acted with the other plan aggressively, right?
Yeah, and they shut down very aggressively, and it remains to be seen how many people have died as a result of the lockdown there. But I just thought it was interesting to note that, in particular, Venezuela and Cuba have been incredibly successful in comparison to everywhere else in Latin America, and they of course. They opted for a lockdown.
Yeah.
The difference is there's a huge difference between a lockdown in a country with a government that will go out of its way to feed you and a country that, you know.
Will go out of its way to steal your lunch.
Yeah. Well, much so.
Right.
I'm almost literally in Honduras.
Right, that's right.
Anyway. So there, and I just thought that was an interesting comment given the situation that Venezuela is having to face, and you know, and in the rest of the region, and switching to Colombia because the situation in Venezuela and Colombia seems to me they're inseparable situation. It's an inseparable situation because so much of what happens in Venezuela is very much affected by the extremely counterproductive behavior of the extreme right wing government that's in Colombia, and so in Colombia, you have this situation with the arrival of the U.S. troops. There's a lot of controversy over the government's policy on COVID-19 that is disproportionate. It's causing huge suffering for the people who live in especially people who live in what's often called the informal economy, what we call here in Nicaragua, we call the social economy. And I thought it was really interesting that I don't have the figures for Colombia, but I'd be very surprised if less than 80% of the country's economy was not in the hands of small and medium sized businesses. That's certainly the case in Mexico, and it's certainly the case here in Nicaragua, where the private business sector, the private company sector, only accounts for about maybe 15 to 20% of the country's employment, something like that.
Yeah.
Which is why when they, back in 2018, when they tried to impose what they were calling a strike, but which was in effect a boss's lockout, that had practically no effect at all, because the huge majority of people in Nicaragua work in the social, what we call the social economy, the popular economy, and that didn't stop at all. And it was And I think, and that's also the situation in Mexico. You have a situation in Mexico where the big business are looking at the way their counterparts in the United States got these massive billion-dollar handouts or more from the U.S. government, and that sector, the kind of the very wealthy private business sector in Mexico, they're trying to strong arm Andrés Manuel López Obrador into putting Mexico into more debt and using the money that they get from, say, the IMF or whoever, because there is this emergency fund that the IMF have made available for countries that are suffering from COVID-19 to protect their economies.
Right.
And what the Mexican big business sector is trying to push López Obrador to do is to take advantage of that lending facility, push Mexico into debt, but give it to them, right?
Right.
So
take the money and give it to me. Yeah, right. I'm in favor of that, you know.
So but what López Obrador is saying is, no, you're wealthy enough. You can work out the crisis without any governmental help.
Right.
You know, and free markets and all that.
Right.
And so that's the background to what's going on in Mexico at the moment. I suspect, I haven't seen the figures, but I suspect that Colombia will in fact have taken advantage of that lending facility to be able to pass money to its big business sector on the pretext of helping the economy recover from the effects of the pandemic. And that whole issue of debt is it doesn't only affect countries like Colombia. It affects, and for example, here in Central America, Nicaragua did ask for a small amount of money from the IMF to help stabilize its economy, and of course was turned down because the United States is imposing financial restrictions on Nicaragua that have not yet reached the level that they have against Venezuela and Cuba. And it's possible that they won't, because it's much more complicated in the case of because Nicaragua is so involved in Central American integration. It'll be quite difficult for the U.S. authorities, I should imagine, to impose the kinds of trade sanctions on Nicaragua that they imposed on Venezuela and Cuba. We'll see.
That relationship with Taiwan might also bedevil that effort a little bit. You know, it's a different situation than it is for most of the other Latin American countries.
Yeah, and even Panama, El Salvador, and Costa Rica, they've abandoned, over the last 3-4 years, they've all abandoned Taiwan and to open up relations with the People's Republic of China. Right. And Nicaragua has stuck with Taiwan.
Yeah.
And there are historical reasons for that. But what I was going to say was that in El Salvador and in Honduras, both those countries, and Honduras took, and I think they've taken, I don't think this is the total amount of money that they've taken in order from the international financial institutions in order to counteract the economic effects of the COVID-19 virus. They last week they signed a loan agreement of about $500 million, which is huge in Central America.
Yeah.
And in El Salvador, it's even worse. I know President Bukele there has indebted El Salvador to the tune of $3 billion.
I mean, this is a phenomenon that we're looking at, by the way, you know, across the world, including in the United States. And there's going to be a moment when everybody's going to finish doing their books and see who owes who what. And I think there's going to be a real crisis that's going to come down, as usual, of course, on those least able to manage it. And we have to stop here, but we can pick it up at that point maybe next week. And Tony, thank you very much for your time, and we'll speak with you again.
Okay, you're very welcome, Don. Look forward to it.
Thanks. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.